Hello and welcome to Baseball America's Draft Podcast. I'm Carlos Glazo, joined by Peter Flaherty. We've all got college baseball fever these days, Peter. Perhaps you more literally than others. How are you feeling?
Good. I can measure my college baseball fever as 102.8 degrees as of last night. So I've definitely got the bug, but no, I physically have felt better, but still fired up to talk through everything with you here today.
Yeah, we've got some moving and some shaking in week two. It's still very early, but there's still directionally some movements on the board, some early feedback coming in from scouts, some loud performances. So we've got plenty to talk about today. Probably we'll focus mostly on top of the board players this week. On the website, I wrote about most of our top college pitchers after 2 weeks. Me and Ben have talked about this in the past. We probably talked about it as well, Peter, but maybe we even mentioned it last week. But I just feel like you can get earlier takeaways from pitchers. You need fewer games to get a good read on like how they've changed, if they've changed, and then their performance is a lot less reliant on the competition and the sample size. You can just kind of see what the stuff is coming out of their hand and have a decent understanding of what's going on. So there are four pretty in-depth scouting reports on each of the four pitchers we have in the first round on the site, in addition to some quicker notes on all of our top 100 arms, plus Patrick Forbes, who will be a top 100 arm on our next update pretty confidently. But yeah, I guess I'll just throw it to you, Peter. Are there any pitchers who have really stood out to you at this point? I mean, we've got Jamie Arnold and Tyler Bremner as like kind of the clear top two guys. Do you view it the same today? And are there any guys who are like jumping into first round range or that you would expect maybe to jump into first round range based on what they've shown in the first few weeks?
So coming into the year, we had long pegged Arnold and Bremner as kind of 1A and 1B, no matter how you slice it, for the top college pitchers in the class. And I think at least at this point, through 2 weeks of the season, it's becoming a little bit more clear, at least for me, that Arnold is the number one guy, and then it's Bremner in the two spot. I mean, he's been as good as you can get through two starts. He hasn't allowed an earned run. He's allowed three hits, 16 Ks, so no walks. He's seen a jump in stuff. I think that, you know, there was chatter in the fall and we saw it on video and, you know, about his changeup and the progression and the leaps that it took. And I think that it's real. I mean, right now you're looking at a left-handed starter who attacks hitters from a low three quarters, really uncomfortable slot, that has a mid-90s fastball that jumps out of his hand with life through the zone. The slider has long been his trademark pitch. He manipulates its shape well. It's long, it's sharp, and then the changeup has been kind of a revelation. It's really flashed in the first couple of weekends. So he's kind of right now not only SP1, but I think he's got a, like, I mean, at least right now, and we'll talk about it more throughout the pod, but I mean, he's got a chance at least, you know, to be in that 1-1 conversation going forward.
Yeah, we're kind of having some early conversations about the next draft update, who's going to rank number one. I think it's a fairly wide open race at this point, but on the college side, I'm not sure if there's a player who has made like a 1-1 case better than Arnold so far. And again, like, it's very early, it's 2 weeks. Don't want to overreact too much, but I would tend to agree with you. I mean, he's basically been as good as you can expect someone to be. You mentioned the changeup. That was an area coming into this spring that a lot of scouts were just kind of curious to see him show that pitch more frequently. In 24, he used the pitch 4% of the time, almost exclusively versus righties. That usage rate overall is up 10%. It's a 15% usage rate versus righties this year. In terms of its movement profile, I think it's got a chance to be a plus pitch. Like, it's got a ton of arm side fading life. It's got a ton of tumble. It moves a lot, like to the point where Arnold himself even told, I'm not sure if it was specifically to us, but Jacob wrote about how, like he had mentioned, he struggles to control it because the movement profile is so extreme. So he's not landing it in the zone as frequently as the fastball and slider, but just the flashes of that pitch that he's shown, I think have to be pretty encouraging. This is a guy who's shown strong command in the past. I would expect that's a pitch that as he continues to use it more frequently, he'll get some better feel for it. And if he's throwing his fastball and slider for strikes 70% of the time, it's not like he needs to have the changeup be, in the zone that frequently. But yeah, down the stretch, it'll be interesting to see how he develops feel for that pitch. And at this point, I think Arnold is kind of above everyone else in the college class.
Yeah, I mean, it's a left-handed starter with front of the rotation upside. It's strikes, it's stuff. You got, I mean, I think you could very easily argue 3+ pitches at this point, mm-hmm. especially with his fastball and slider. It's getting increasingly more difficult to, I'd say, pick out warts in his game. Mm-hmm.
And he looks odd. That's like the one word I have. It just is a weird look, but I think yeah. that plays to his benefit.
Yeah, the arm stroke is a little weird and long and funky, but like you said, it does play in his favor. It's a real difficult look for opposing hitters. And he's just been outstanding. I think the other guy that we'd be remiss not to talk about is Liam Doyle from Tennessee.
Oh my gosh.
I mean, he's just been insane.
So he's two starts. He had 11 strikeouts versus Hofstra in 5 innings, week 1. And then he followed that up with 14 strikeouts versus Samford in week 2. He's sitting 95, and he has a 40.9% swinging strike rate. Not a miss rate. If that was 40% of the swings against his fastball or misses, that would be insane. LP Langevin from a year ago had a 46% miss rate. He has a 40.9% swinging strike rate. So every pitch, four out of 10 fastballs he's throwing are getting whiffs. It's truly insane. Yeah, he's been dominant. I didn't mean to cut you off, but go ahead, Peter. Break it down more.
No, you summed it up perfectly. It's particularly the fastball characteristics and results that have stood out to me, like you said. And I mean, it's a 72% miss rate, which is just nutty. It's sitting in the mid 90s, been up to 99 with tons of life through the zone. I know I drafted it as like my, I guess, quote unquote fastball in this year's draft. So far so good on that front. But
who did I take? AJ Russell?
Yeah, well, we'll get
into him. Who also came back this week. One of my rare tweets these days, I'd mentioned something like it's going to be impossible to barrel up Tennessee fastballs between Doyle and AJ Russell, who probably entered the year with like the consensus top fastball. And if you wanted to say Doyle, like, it's just silly numbers. So
nuts. And then you throw in guys like Nate Snead, who's also in the mid to upper 90s, Marcus Phillips, who's got a big time arm. It's a really formidable group there down in Knoxville. But with Doyle, it's an interesting look because the numbers are exceptional. The data is equally as impressive. You know, you cite the fastball miss rate, that like shorter, sharper slider has also been effective. But it's a real efforty delivery. He falls off towards the third base side. It's a very high effort look and a strenuous look. So I'm kind of, at least for me, I'm not totally sold on his ability to start professionally, which isn't necessarily a huge knock on him. But I'd say that's the one key thing that's holding me back and probably a lot of others back from penciling him in as this slam dunk first round guy. But I mean, if he keeps this rate is going to be impossible to sustain. But I mean, if he keeps throwing the ball this well or even half as well as he has through SEC play.
Yeah,
you're talking about a Friday night left-handed starter in the SEC with an abundance of success. That profile, regardless of the reliever risk, is not going to last long. So I mean,
yeah, I'm really intrigued to see like what the arsenal is looking like once he faces, like, I don't want to knock too much on the early competition, but I mean, he hasn't faced the best competition he's going to face this year. He's using his fastball 76% of the time. The changeup and then slider cutter between the three of them, it's like a 24% usage there. I'm curious to see how the secondaries develop and what scouts are thinking of those pitches moving forward, because I would want to give this guy every opportunity to start at the next level because his fastball is just so unique and is such a bat misser. But I guess two things, just like what sort of miss rate are we going to settle into once we get further into the season? Because again, unless you can think of another pitcher, LP Langevin's fastball from a year ago is like the biggest fastball miss rate I can remember since we've had access to this sort of data. 46% is like an insane rate. We're talking about this in the Slack, but once in college baseball, at least once pitchers get north of like a 30% miss rate, I kind of open my eyes a little bit and say, oh, this is a real bat missing fastball. Like 40% is just insane, kind of elite. Like I could probably count on one hand the amount of fastballs that I can remember, at least in that range. Like, I don't even think Jack Leiter, his fastball at the time was probably like a 35% miss rate. I might pull that up as you're talking to see what his was at the time, but it's just insane right now. It's only two games, but I mean, he's gotten 43 misses on 105 fastballs that he's thrown. It's truly ludicrous.
Yeah, it's obscene. And I think even when all said and done, let's say he settles in and we're sitting here in May or June when the season's about ended and he's in that like 35 to 40-ish range, which is even still ridiculous, or even if he's like 32 to 33% plus, you're still talking about a fastball, especially from a starting pitcher, that's in the upper echelon of miss rates. And I think people are going to feel rather similarly about it then as they do now, barring something different or the stuff backing up. But yeah, I mean, whoever ends up drafting him, he's going to get every chance to start. Like, he'll pitch his way into the bullpen if that's mm-hmm. how the chips end up falling.
What's also stood out to me is like his fastball location. If you just look at his pitch plot, it's everything is at the top of the zone. Like, he's throwing the pitch for strikes at a high rate. A lot of that is because he's getting a lot of chases above the zone, but he's throwing the pitch exactly where you would want it to be thrown, I would imagine, just given its shape. But I just pulled up Jack Leiter's college, so this is his college data from 2021. He had a 32% miss rate on his fastball, just for some context. And like, we were talking about that pitch as like an elite fastball, Sig 94 with great ride. I think Leiter was probably the sort of poster boy for like vertical approach angle and induced vertical break at the time. I think he was like one of the first college pitchers that had really been broken down in that lens. So there's definitely a lot of talk about that pitch, but Liam Doyles is like a whole different universe right now. But again, that's like a full season's worth of data. We're 2 weeks in, but it's just a silly pitch.
Yeah, he's done a good job of commanding it. Everything's been, for the most part, in the top half of the zone, isolating it even further, more so in the top third of the zone. But like, he can cut it, he can ride it. It's just really impressive what he's done so far for more reasons than just the miss rate. It's kind of how mm-hmm. he's doing it as well. But I wish the delivery was a little more aesthetically pleasing, but
yep.
You know, what can you do? I think the other arm, and I think sticking on Tennessee, like AJ Russell coming back was a huge development. Obviously, it was mm-hmm. before the season, the expectation was, you know, second half of the season, probably in the later portion of SEC play, and ramp him up to the point where you're able to use him for a stretched out amount of time come regionals. But him coming back on Tuesday was like breaking news, and mm-hmm. for everyone, like they kept that one super under wraps. No one saw that coming. Threw just 17 pitches, but struck out the side pretty easily. His body looked better to me when I was watching him, like a little bit more filled out, especially in his lower half, really mm-hmm. under control and effortless delivery, trademark low launch attack angle. But fastball is up to 97 on the stadium gun with its signature mm-hmm. ride and run through the zone. And then he paired it with his slider that flashed two plane tilt with some sharpness. But the fastball with Russell has long been the calling card. Like, that pitch alone mm-hmm. is gonna have him drafted in a pretty good spot, I'd say. So
yeah, sitting 95, touching 97, like, it's hard to ask him to do much more than he did in the limited time he got. Like you said, faced three batters, struck all three out, threw strikes with the fastball. So I'm excited to see how he gets stretched out, what sort of a role he's going to find on this Tennessee squad, because they have an embarrassment of riches both in the lineup and on the pitching staff. It wouldn't shock me if they vaulted into number one status on the top 25 in the near future, depending on like what them and what A&M and LSU are doing. Like, they've been extremely impressive on both sides of the ball. So it's not anything crazy or new to say that all these players at Tennessee are going to get scouted pretty heavily. It's kind of the norm for that program. But yeah, it's good to see him back. And like you said, we did not expect him to come back this early. When I heard that he was pitching, I was like a bit stunned, but also really excited, because early season college baseball, early season spring training feels more like the news. When you hear about any news for injuries, it's bad news. So a nice positive sign early for Russell and for Tennessee.
Yeah, and he has more of that like traditional starter look. He's this strapping, high-waisted 6'6", like 217-pound kid. I believe he's listed at On Tennessee's website, easy delivery. Fastball is probably closer to a 7 than it is a 6. Sliders, you know, you could argue an above average grade on it. The key's going to be developing the third pitch, but he does a great job of competing around the zone. Very under control. There's a lot to like with Russell, and at least just listening to Coach Vitello talk, it sounds like the off the field makeup is really impressive as well. So, a cherry on top to to an already impressive profile. I have to imagine they'll be very cautious with him. Like, I think his next appearance or two or three will look similar to Tuesdays before he gets really stretched out. There's just no need to rush it at all. But I think he'll start getting stretched out way before we all initially thought.
And I think this is fantastic news for him, obviously just being on the mound and being healthy, but he's a guy who really didn't have a ton of track record entering the year. He didn't have a ton of track record as a starter. He started one game in 2023. Otherwise, it was 23 outings out of the pen, just 30 innings, 30.1 specifically. Then 2024, he had 4 starts, 6 appearances, 14.1 innings before he got hurt. So he really does not have an extended track record as a starter at all. And just showing that he's able to do that and getting more, of a resume in that capacity. Like you said, he looks the part, he's got the frame, the delivery is pretty easy, but just showing it in the SEC is going to be really important. And now he's got a lot longer of a runway to actually develop that than what was expected. So that's great news.
Yeah. And then
let's touch on Bremner really quickly, kind of go in the opposite direction. Just go back up the board. How concerned are you at this point for Tyler Bremner? Because it has been a rockier start to the season for him than for Arnold and obviously for a guy like Liam Doyle. He's made both of his first 2 starts, 3 innings, his week 1 start, and then he was pulled as a precaution for some tightness that he felt in cold weather. Came back out next week, 3 more innings. I think from a stuff perspective, Bremner has looked just fine to me. I mean, he's sitting with the same velocity he showed a year ago. He's sitting in the mid-90s. The power to the pitch is there. The changeup looks like its typical elite self. Both the changeup and the slider have actually been really impressive bat missers. It's been the fastball that's kind of gotten hit around. In his second game, he allowed 5 hits, a pair of home runs. 4 of the 5 hits he gave up were fastballs that kind of started on the glove side third of the plate and then ran back over the heart of the zone and got hit hard. I know we were just hearing about Bremner prior to the season. There was some concern that like his fastball can be hittable at times. We've seen that early, but I mean, he's throwing hard, he's throwing strikes, the changeup is missing a lot of bats, he's showing confidence in that pitch and almost pitches off the changeup at times, which I don't necessarily mind because the changeup is just that good and he's able to land it at will. The slider is flash plus. That was maybe his most inconsistent pitch entering the year. I thought that looked really good, especially in his second game. Would just like to see him start pitching a little bit further into games and really be confident that that forearm tightness doesn't turn into anything serious, because you do get a little bit scared every time you hear about forearm tightness. But where are you at with Bremner?
Yeah, hearing about the forearm tightness gave me the bad shivers a little bit. But I think with him, he's also a victim of how well Jamie Arnold's throwing. I think it's easy to exacerbate, you know, a couple of meh outings, especially when the guy that you've been going toe-to-toe with and have been talked about toe-to-toe with has been near perfect through 2 starts. But I'm not super worried, at least to this point. Obviously, the forearm tightness is going to be something to watch going forward and just seeing how he looks as the season progresses. But it's kind of clear the smoke and scuttlebutt on him is to hunt the fastball, particularly early in counts, and see if you can ambush it. I think 5 of the hits he's given up, 3 have come in either within the first 3 pitches of the at-bat or in a plus-plus count. And then, like you said and you wrote and pointed out, it comes with the fastball running back over the heart of the plate. So, I mean, if it starts into lefties, it'll run back over kind of the middle half, middle third. And then to righties, if it starts out, it'll kind of run back over the middle as well, and they'll put a barrel to it. So I think commanding the fastball a little bit better will warrant more positive results. But the changeup's been excellent. The slider's also flashed. And one of the homers was simply you know, hit or beat you. I mean,
yeah, I thought the second home run he allowed in week two was a really well located pitch. Like, it was down and in. I thought it was just a nice swing. The first one he gave up definitely ran back over the heart of the plate. Maybe it's not the sort of execution you want, but I'm kind of with you. I'm not too concerned as long as the health checks out. I think that Bremner has this sort of secondaries and command to be able to mix and match enough to keep hitters honest on the fastball, because it's not like he's throwing a soft fastball. It's a 95 mile per hour pitch on average. It does have a lot of movement, and I think it maybe is just a case of being a little bit more precise with it, or just pitching backwards more frequently, which he can do. I wonder if teams will want to maybe try and tweak the shape of that pitch at the next level, if that's something that will be considered, because there is a lot of noise in the data we have on Bremner's fastball. I don't think he gets as much riding life, particularly that we have on the spreadsheet. But either way, I think there's plenty to work with here, and he's got the ability to do enough with the changeup and the slider to keep hitters honest. So I'm still pretty excited for the total package with Bremner.
Yeah, 100%. As long as the health is, as you said, as long as that checks out and he's 100% fine, especially in his throwing arm, then, you know, so be it. Right now he's got 3+ pitches. I mean, you could, yeah, I mean, I think the fastball, you could argue, depending on the day, you could say 55 or a 6, but I still got it as a 6. The changeup is one of the best of its kind, and then the slider is also a plus pitch. So, I mean,
I think, if I remember correctly, the fastball and changeup were his most effective pitches, and the slider was the pitch that got hit around a little bit and was a bit more inconsistent. So I think he's probably, and maybe this was even the case last year, but there were a few outings where the fastball just got hit around and he made the adjustments, and overall it was a really effective pitch. So I'm pretty bullish on him, I'd say, compared, if people are freaking out about Bremner, I think there's a lot to look at in a positive lens. Like, he looks like the same guy to me so far in the limited stints we've seen him that he did a year ago from a stuff perspective.
Yeah, and to your point about the slider, the jumps that it's taken year over year since arriving on campus have been really impressive, even between his freshman and sophomore year, and then sophomore spring to this summer. It's looked more and more like a bona fide plus swing and miss pitch. So I'm with you, clean up the fastball a little bit, but I think it's more so like Arnold is rather clearly SP1 now, and it's like Arnold in the field, as opposed to this 1A and 1B, but, you know, we're two starts in. And then I guess the last arm that I wanted to touch on was to just reiterate Patrick Forbes, and how impressive he's been to start the year through two starts. He's allowed 2 earned runs through 10 innings, 20 Ks to just 1 walk. I love the body. I mean, he's this physical, athletic kid at 6'3", 220. There's an appealing degree of explosiveness in his delivery. Fastball has been into the mid to upper 90s with a ton of life in the top half of the zone. And then the slider has also flashed plus with this sharp 2-plane break and impressive finish. So he's primarily a 2-pitch guy right now. You're going to have to develop a third, but the clay is there. Like, he's a low mileage arm. Like, he started pitching full time just last year. And this will be his first year that he spends entirely in the rotation. So, I mean, he's a good athlete. He's got stuff. He competes around the zone. There's just a lot to like. I mean, if he's an arm that I can pluck with my second or even early third pick in the draft, I highly doubt he'll be there for two or three picks in the
third
draft.
Third pick seems unlikely at this stage, unless you're like the Orioles or someone else who's got a lot of extra picks, maybe the Royals' third pick.
Yeah, I mean, if I can get him with my second pick in the draft, I'd be thrilled. So he's obviously going to go out and do it in ACC play, but just a really impressive 2+ pitch combo, at least so far.
Yeah, absolutely. I don't have too much more to add on Forbes. He summed it up nicely. He's been a positive, definitely a positive storyline early this year. All right, let's move on from the pitchers, get into some of the hitters, especially college hitters at the top of the board. Peter, I do think that at this point we've heard it from enough scouts to start to kind of question Jace Laviolette's grip on 1-1. He's the top player on our board at this stage. I don't think early on, again, for hitters, probably we need to have a little bit more time. But some of the questions we've had from the scouting community are just related to how the body looks, maybe some of the athleticism that is not quite as loud, as it was a year ago. Through seven games, he's hitting 217, 438, 652. He's got three home runs, one double. In classic Jace Laviolette fashion, he is walking a ton. He's got a 28.1% walk rate. That's with nine walks, 10 strikeouts, good for a 31.3% strikeout rate. So it's kind of the same patient, selective Jace Laviolette with miss concerns. It's been a lot of swing and miss early this season against most pitch types. And I've just heard from some scouts who are kind of wondering about the body at this point. He's not running quite as well early. And he did already have a bit of an unconventional 1-1 college hitter profile. I don't think he's trending in the right direction. What are your thoughts on Laviolette and what you've been hearing? Because I know both you, Jacob, myself, we've all talked to people who are kind of looking at Jace, and maybe we've got some more questions than we were hoping to have at this stage.
Yeah, I'm with you. I think the main, I don't know if you can call it red flag or critique, whatever you want to say, but I think the main aspect with him that's been pointed out is how the body's looked. You know, last year he was this, he still is 6'5", 6'6", but you know, he was this 6'6", Adonis, like physical athlete, like really good body, moved really well, could go and get it in center field a little bit, posted plus run times down the line. This year he's more filled out, and you know, some guys filling out like Merrick Houston, that's a real positive development. But to with Laviolette, you know, how much of that weight is good weight, and how much of it is taking away from kind of that sneaky and appealing athleticism and speed that he displayed in the outfield, or you know, run times wise. I think they're, and you know, he's off to a slow start. He's making contact, I think, at just a 68% overall clip. Mm-hmm. And I think the main thing is just the, again, just kind of the body. It's, the transformation has been interesting, to say the least. And, I don't really know what you have to add on it. I'm trying to not be as harsh.
Well, I mean, he still has impressive physical tools. The raw power is obviously still there. But I think I've just heard similar questions from scouts that you've heard, like the body just looks a little bit bigger. The athleticism doesn't look quite as explosive. I mean, he had been a guy who had turned in 70 grade run times at his best, like a 6'6", 230 pound player running plus is impressive. And I don't think we're getting that quite as much. I've heard from some scouts too, who just think the swing is looking a little bit different. Like to me, when I looked at it, I thought the swing is a bit stiffer than it was even a year ago. There's less movement in his hands pre-pitch. He's kind of taking a high handset and going directly to the ball in his swing. I don't necessarily think that specifically is a huge issue, but it's an odd look to me. I would imagine there are probably some scouts who look at him and wonder where the rhythm is at in his swing, and if that is like part of the reason why there's so much swing and miss for a guy who does have a good understanding of the zone and seems to pick out the pitches he needs to be swinging at. And so if you're looking at Jace Laviolette and you're saying, okay, now we're much more likely to think of him as a definite corner profile who is maybe an average runner than this outlier athlete who could play center field and be a plus runner, I do think that colors the profile quite a bit. And when you're swinging and missing this much at this stage in the season, I mean, the one question he needed to answer and really improve upon this spring to cement himself as the 1-1 was just making more contact. And so far we haven't seen it. We'll see how he does moving forward. But for whatever you thought of the 1-1 conversation preseason, it is more open today than it was then.
Yeah.
In my mind.
No, I'm with you. And if I was forced to pick at one and I'm the Nationals right now, I'm probably taking Jamie Arnold, at least at this stage. Yeah. That's a conversation that'll be ongoing. But I'm happy you brought up the swing with Laviolette, because on top of him looking a bit bigger, it is kind of a unique look in the box. Like, no one's going to see this that I'm doing it, but it is this. Like,
I can, Peter. That... I can appreciate it.
And it's just like, I'm looking at video of it right now. It's just like very, like kind of stiff and rigid, and it's just this like, you know, it's not this like smooth rhythmic left-handed stroke, or you know, for righties a smooth, it's just not a a smooth aesthetic.
This is a very different hitter, and it's from the right side, but it reminds me of the critique that Caleb Bonnemer got as a high schooler last year. Like he is just so still in the box, and there's like next to no movement, and he got a lot of critiques from scouts because of that. And I wonder if the same scouts who are maybe a little worried about Bonnemer's will also have similar concerns about Laviolette's.
Yeah, no, it'll be interesting to follow. Yeah, he's an interesting case. Like, like you said, the biggest thing going into this year for him and a lot of other guys was to make more contact, improve upon the hit tool. And so far it's been a little bit of a tough go, but like you said, the physical tools and physicality with him are impressive, maybe a little bit more impressive, especially in the body's physicality, than one would like. He's still got double plus raw power, but it's not this kind of like strong looking like he's certainly not as lean as he was last year. So we'll see how he does in SEC play, but certainly something to watch, I'd say, going forward.
Yeah, well, there are a couple of college hitters that are trending up and maybe putting some pressure on Jace at this stage, and it's a trio of college shortstops really that I wanted to talk about today. Ava Arquette at Oregon State, Dean Curley at Tennessee, and then Merrick Houston, who we talked about last week but has still just been performing really well at Wake Forest. All three of these college shortstops are off to a great start. I can pull up their numbers and kind of outline them, but I mean, Ava Arquette has this big physical frame. I think at this point you look at a guy like Ava Arquette, he has the sort of size and leanness still. Like he doesn't look like he's as filled out as Jace Laviolette is, but his bat speed has been impressive. He's hitting. I really want to bear down on his defense a little bit more because he is such a big player for shortstop. Dean Curley, he's played shortstop and third base. Looks like Tennessee kind of slides around their left side of the infield to get some good defensive alignments with Ariel Antigua playing some shortstop for them. But he's showing great plate discipline. He's hitting the ball hard. Merrick Houston obviously has added more power, looks stronger. Early performance for all three of these players has been exceptional, and I imagine all three of them have a shot to go in the sort of top 10 range or get even closer. They're all kind of guys we had in the 11 to 21 ish range. I don't know exactly where we had Merrick, but yeah, they're all middle first round names who are pushing more towards top of the first round at this stage.
Yeah, 100%. It's a very exciting trio. We were excited about them coming into the year, but I mean, you hit on everything perfectly. Like with Arquette, it's this really appealing, like lean, athletic look, long-limbed kid with, you know, present strength, but there's more, it looks like, to kind of fill out more and become this maximized product physically. And I mean, he's already got at least above average bat speed. I think he posted one of his home runs, I think, was a 113 mile an hour exit velocity, or one of his doubles. But his max EV this year, I think, is 113.
His bat speed is what jumped out to me just immediately watching on video. Like after watching a lot of these guys, Arquette really, like sometimes I think on video it's harder to see bat speed for whatever reason, but with Arquette it was like pretty obvious.
Yeah, it's impressive bat speed. It's all fields impact, at least early on. And then also in the early going, he was kind of one of those guys that fit into the bucket of, you know, let's see an improved hit tool, both in terms of contact rate, and also chase rate. And so far, the results have been, I'd say positive.
He's missing at a 19% rate, chasing at a 23% clip. I believe both of those are improvements from his overall numbers from a year ago. He's swinging 40% of the time. So pretty good there just in terms of how it looks under the table.
Yeah. And Curley's just been fantastic. I mean, he was really good last year as a freshman. This year he's hitting .385 with three homers, eight RBIs, nine walks, so just two Ks in eight games. This impressive looking athlete in the box with effortless hand and bat speed. Doesn't sell out at all to get to his impact. He can hammer the baseball to all fields. And it's really impressive, and it's becoming more impressive, I'd say, by the game hit power combo.
Yep.
I think you can argue plus power. And then also on the hit tool this year so far, he's making contact at a 90% overall clip, chasing at just a 17% overall clip, which is really impressive. And then in the zone, he's posted a 97% overall contact rate. He swung and missed just once. according to Synergy on a Pitch in the Zone. And then we talked about Merrick Houston already at length, but he's got 5 home runs in 9 games, 6 walks to 3 Ks, 20 RBIs already. The physical transformation, I guess, on one end of the spectrum, you have Jace's transformation, and then on the other, you've got Merrick's transformation, and it's kind of a, his has been super, super positive. Like, the one knock on Houston, we talked about it last week, but it was his lack of impact. Mm-hmm. And then throughout last summer, and especially this fall and winter, he totally transformed his body. Looks like a totally different human being in the best way. And it's just this, like, very physical in a good way, like 6'3", 205, 210. I mean, it's a big league body now with Houston, and it's translated to more impact. The contact skills are still there. I think in zone, he's posted overall, it's been an 89% overall contact rate, 94% overall in zone contact rate, the feel for the barrels there. And there's just an added degree of explosiveness to how he looks in the box. And like you said, no one, I don't think, is asking for him to be this even like 50 power guy. Like last year, it was like 30 in game for Merrick Houston, and especially this summer. And I'm sure that there will be people who are kind of spooked by the summer, because on the Cape with Wood, I think his max exit velo was like 93, 94, which was.
Yeah, like, but I don't think he had that full physical transformation yet. So even if it's not going to be like the juiced metal bats, college baseball EVs for him moving forward, I think you can have the confidence to upgrade whatever your power projection was after that summer or after last spring. And we've gotten to the point with these three shortstops, I think they're all fairly well-rounded players at this stage. Like, you probably have preferences for one or the other, depending on what you like. Like, if you really love upside and physical tools, like, Ava Arquette is just a player you can dream on. I mean, his power potential at the position, he's gotten some like Troy Tulowitzki comps because of his size. I'm sure it will vary who you talk to, like how they see it playing at shortstop moving forward defensively. But I've talked to some people who are like kind of shocked how good he's looked there with Dean Curley. I think it is probably the best or the most comfortable I feel with a hit and a power combination, just his ability to recognize pitches, his contact skills, his strength. Like, he's just a well-rounded hitter. Probably the least likely in my mind of these three to play shortstop. I think he's going to be a third baseman or maybe a second baseman at the next level. But even then, I still really like that profile. I think he could be a good third baseman, could be a good second baseman. And then with Merrick Houston, you have the safest defensive shortstop profile of them all. You've got a guy who had a long track record as being this really hit forward, contact oriented player who's suddenly coming into his strength, runs well, turns in plus run time. So, like, depending on what you're looking for in a shortstop and what your preferences are, any of these three guys are really appealing. And I just think, like, you don't often get college shortstops that you feel this confident in, because a lot of them just go in high school. That I really like this group, and it would be unsurprising for all three of them to be gone before the 16th pick of the draft the way they're going right now.
Yeah, it's quite the trio. And like you said, each one kind of, you know, has their own appealing traits. I think there's something for everyone here in the trio of guys. But I think circling back to
Merrick, what would you say, just because I'm assuming you have Merrick one defensively, how would you line up the other two from a defensive standpoint? Because I think Ava has better actions as a shortstop than Dean Curley does, but I could see you saying, like, well, Ava's body is just such an outlier for the position. Like, you basically have to think he's Ellie De La Cruz or an O'Neill Cruz type, where he's just such a freak that he'll make it work. But I mean, we have started to see more big shortstops at the position.
Yeah, it's an interesting question, because Curley, I'd give the nod to arm strength wise. Like, for me, it's a 55 pushing a 6. Arquette isn't quite there. But from what I saw this summer, I mean, I caught him a handful of times, ranging from June to when he left in the later part of July. And I was really impressed with how just the actions and game clock in general improved. Like, when I saw him early in June, like, it's clear he needed a couple of coats of polish, especially from, you know, a game clock perspective. It just wasn't quite there, and I kind of had him penciled in as a definite, you know, potential third base, second base type. But when I caught him again, like, it looked a lot more smooth. The arm strength had always kind of been there. and it was still there. The game clock had improved. He made a couple of impressive plays coming in on the baseball, ranging to his glove side and into the hole. I think that all three of these guys will get every chance to, like, Merrick's going to stick at shortstop. I'd be shocked if he doesn't. I think you got to give guys like Arquette and Curley a chance to at least stick there. And in terms of who has a better chance of sticking there, I'd probably maybe lean Arquette over Curley, okay, even though the body type is such an anomaly.
Yeah, I kind of view Dean Curley in my mind as like a Matt Shaw type defender, type shortstop. Like, I think Matt Shaw is a better runner than Curley, but I agree with you. I think I would go plus on Dean's arm and just think he's going to be a really solid third baseman, second baseman. I'd be more willing to move him quickly because I just don't think he has the actions for shortstop at the next level. So,
yeah, the actions aren't like the suave, smooth of like Iva and especially Merrick. He's going to hit enough no matter where you stick him. So, like, I'm not, like, positionally, I don't think it's too much of a ward. But yeah.
With all three of these guys, you should have been on our amateur player draft because somehow Ben and Jacob allowed me to draft all three of these players. Dean Curley on the corner outfield. I took Merrick Houston shortstop, and I got Ava Arquette as my utility player with the very last pick that I had. I lucked out.
Holy cow. Jeez Louise. Well, I mean, you look good so far.
Well, fingers crossed. I also took Jamie Arnold 1-1, so that was tracking nicely as well.
Yeah,
so.
I don't care who you took out after those four guys. It could be local.
Let me be really confident today before we look up at the end of the spring and find out that I finished last on Draft Capital. So I'll take my wins where I can get them.
Oh man, well, this has just been the podcast that talks about your draft in the end. But it's a really fun trio. I think like the openness, especially at the top of the draft, and we kind of cited it even this fall and winter with guys being able to play their way into that 1-1 conversation. Like, there isn't this bona fide star at the top like there was last year with Travis Bazzana, JJ Weatherholt. Like, at least early on in the cycle, people were even throwing around Condon and Caglione. I personally wasn't. But that wasn't the case this year. I mean, I think for the most part, it's kind of wide open, which is going to make it a lot of fun.
It'll make a lot of fun. It'll make it a bit of a nightmare for mock draft purposes. But I mean, that's kind of been the situation for a while now. I think Adley Rutschman 1-1 in 2019. And then, Spencer Torkelson, I think it was like pretty clear at that point. And then what were the other ones we had in recent years? I guess for the 2023 draft on draft day, we're all pretty confident it was going to be Langford or Skeens. And even if it wasn't one of those two, like, we all knew the trio of college names that were likely, and then the next two high school players. But it does feel like they're at this point, there are a lot more players than just five kind of in the mix at the top of the board. And again, we'll see if someone takes 1-1 and strangles it and just keeps it for the rest of the spring. I'll be curious to hear how the reviews from high school players like Ethan Holliday, Seth Hernandez, Xavier Nyans, Cruz Schoolcraft, some of these high school shortstops as well, if they're going to play themselves into a position to be talked about in that capacity right now. But the college side has been a lot of fun early on. Anything else you want to mention before we get out of here, Peter?
No, I mean, I think that, you know, speaking of fun trios, and we'll probably talk about it next week or in due time, that catching trio of Luke Stevenson, Caden Bodine, and Ike Irish is also, you know, I think there's something in there that tickles everyone's fancy. I think the gap between Stevenson and Bodine is not / should not be as wide as it might be, as it might be being made out to be. And then also with Cam Cannarell, I kind of worry a little bit about his shoulder. So, foreshadowing to future episodes, but those are the other two points I wanted to bring up.
Cool. All right. Well, on the site, we'll have plenty of stuff from a college and draft standpoint, draft notebooks each week. Peter has his What to Watch For that you can read probably as you're listening to this podcast. If you want to get ready for what's happening this weekend, we'll have updated top 25. We've got, shockingly enough, I'm already working on our updated in-season draft list. I know Peter's working on our class draft list. So we got plenty coming on the draft and college side specifically. We've got spring training and the prospect wire on the pro side live on the site. So if you need to just keep up with what's happening from prospects who are in affiliated ball. Definitely check out the Prospect Wire. We're constantly updating that with news and notes, performances, injury, plenty of injury news early this season, which sucks, but it's just a reality. But yeah, definitely check out the site. Consider subscribing to Baseball America if you guys have not yet. We really appreciate it. You guys allow us to do what we do. So thanks for listening to today's episode. For Peter, I'm Carlos. We'll see you next time, everybody. So long.